This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Joe Johnson is often the only black information technology person in the room. He works to change that.
We try to introduce students to information technology concepts. I'm proud of the fact that we got kids scholarships because they developed components that were nationally recognized.
Our series Living Black in Bloomington Normal continues. Plus, ISU students react to courses mostly moving online for the school term that starts in just a few more days. And housing insecurity for young people is growing the longer the pandemic lasts. That and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. District 87 has suspended band camp at Bloomington High School after a parent said their child tested positive for the coronavirus. Superintendent Barry Riley says the district made the move out of an abundance of caution and has closely followed safety protocols for the 150 kids in the outdoor camp.
And our band directors have been very good about communicating this. There's a solid form of communication with parents in the band, parents of kids in the band, so they're well aware of those precautions.
Riley says the district is waiting for guidance from the McLean County Health Department on when they should resume. McLean County health officials have announced 13 new coronavirus cases today. The number of active cases dropped slightly. The county's seven-day positivity rate holds steady at 2%. Congressman Rodney Davis says he is trying to get to the bottom of why COVID-19 testing resources promised to Illinois State University were reallocated elsewhere. The Taylorville Republican says it appears the third-party vendor contracted by ISU also offered testing equipment to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Davis says he's in contact with the department but hasn't yet heard back.
We've got to get answers from HHS on whether or not that vendor actually had access to those test kits if they possibly overpromised too many people on ones that they had access to.
ISU moved the majority of classes online due to the unexpected limitation on testing capacity and the increase in cases locally. Davis says they'll look into other vendor options to facilitate a safe campus reopening. Those struggling to keep up with utility bills are encouraged to explore assistance options now, as a moratorium on disconnections and late penalties is set to expire at the end of the month. One option is the state-run Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP. Mark Cotty is with Mid-Central Community Action, which helps with applications in McLean County. He says the sooner people apply, the better.
Of course, the funds are limited. I mean, it's not a bottomless, pit. But they have been increased this year by the government simply because of the COVID-19 situation.
Illinois received an additional $41 million in federal stimulus for LIHEAP. Cotty says the Mid-Central Community Action received more than 700 applications within 2 days of being open, and more are coming in by the day. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University will be mostly online this fall. That shift in opening strategy came amid a rise in cases and the unexpected loss of federal testing supplies. Several ISU students and faculty are welcoming the decision. Ryan Denham reports.
Lauren Harris certainly picked an interesting time to become ISU's student body president.
And this COVID-19 was not on my radar when election season happened at all.
Elected last spring, Harris takes over the top spot in student government this fall on a campus that will look very, very different from years past. Harris accepts it. She says what we knew as normal does not exist anymore. She supports ISU's move to a mostly online format this fall.
I think that this is a good decision just because really it's what the science is telling us.
It's unclear how the decision will impact enrollment, particularly among freshmen. Students ponder how much they're willing to pay for a mostly online experience. Harris says her concern is not so much with tuition as it is with fees, which support a wide range of on-campus activities, including the Bone Student Center and Student Fitness Center. The university already faces a pending federal lawsuit from two students who claim ISU did not refund enough of their mandatory fees after abruptly shifting to online classes last spring.
That's an area where I do believe that there should have been some adjustment in terms of that, as we know that, you know, most of the things that we normally would have, you know, at the university will look dramatically different.
ISU's dorms will remain open for students, albeit with new safety precautions. For those who change their minds, ISU's housing and meal plan contract cancellation date has been extended, with no penalty, to August 18th. It's also unclear how many ISU students will be living in McLean County this fall. Tuesday's announcement certainly opened the door for remote learning from anywhere, but many students have already signed off-campus apartment leases. Provost Andovar Tarhule says it's a difficult issue with no easy answer.
But it's not something that we are unaware of, or it's something that we have neglected. It's something that basically we've had to balance against the risk that we thought the campus as a whole would face if we had students back at the numbers that we were working on previously.
Math professor Fusen Ackman says she was not surprised by the pivot to online classes.
We were expecting something of this sort to happen in a few weeks. I'm just happy that it occurred much earlier. Everything was pointing in this direction. This was the inevitable conclusion of the path that ISU decided to take.
Ackman has been critical of the ISU administration's handling of the pandemic, particularly what she describes as an overly secret reopening decision-making process. She also criticized ISU leaders for not having a full testing plan in place before announcing that students would return to campus. Ackman shared her concerns at a recent Board of Trustees meeting.
I think we did make a difference. I think a larger disaster has been averted. Now the point is to contain the disaster.
Justin Vickers is an associate professor of music. He says he'd already reworked his voice lessons and opera practicum courses to keep students safe during the pandemic. Vickers praised the ISU administration's handling of the crisis thus far.
I remain positive. I remain hopeful. I remain grateful for our leadership and the fact that at every turn, in my experience, they have sought to hear the voices of our faculty, our staff, and our students alike.
The fall semester begins August 17th. I'm Ryan Denham.
In announcing the pivot to online classes, ISU pointed the finger at the federal government, claiming the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reallocated to another location 3 testing machines and 5,000 reagent kits the university had ordered. WGLT has reached out to HHS for comment, but has yet to hear back.
Support for WGLT comes from Communication Junction, offering in-person and virtual sign-and-play classes beginning August 24th to promote early communication for children ages birth to 5 years in Bloomington, Washington, and Peoria. Details at communicationjunction.net. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, at-risk young people are at more risk, the longer the pandemic goes on, of becoming homeless. The story in just a few minutes. The head of the firm that runs the COVID-19 testing site at the Interstate Center in Bloomington says recent processing delays have been resolved and its track record for getting results quickly remains strong, even though the number of daily tests at the site has quadrupled in the last month. CEO of Reditus Labs in Pekin, Aaron Rossi, tells Eric Stock 99% of the company tests are processed within 48 hours, but
I can't control what happens after we do the testing. You're talking about multiple different vendors here. And once we release the result, then it goes through the whole system. So I can't comment on when the patient gets the phone call because I'm not in charge of that. But with the ones that I am, you know, when we do our testing and we take care of the process, everybody's getting their results within 24 to 48 hours.
Is the supply chain strong enough to handle all of the testing that is being done right now, not only the increase we've seen locally, but long-term care facilities and all the other testing that's being done across the state?
Yeah, I think that's a $1 million question. And if you answer that, then you should run for governor or president, you know, so I can't comment on that. I know that there's a lot of demand for it. I can tell you that. That's all I can tell you. You know, on my side, I'm just worrying about what I take care of here, trying to do our best work to, you know, make sure as many people can get tested as possible. You know, this is COVID-19 is something that's not, it is brand new. So we're building the road as we try to drive down the road on multiple different levels and facets by also trying to get as much access to individuals with testing as possible.
Have you had to increase staff for Bloomington?
Oh, yes. Double our staff in Bloomington. We've added, 15 new people to the laboratory space for internal infrastructure. You know, more call center support, we've added a lot of staff. I couldn't even give you the exact number, but I know we doubled our staffing in Bloomington after the 4th of July when we saw a large uptick.
You alluded to the fact that things have picked up considerably. Things started out after Reditas took over, maybe 150, 200 a day. Now we're seeing 600 per day plus. What do you think the reason for the change has been?
I'm not quite sure. I think one of the biggest things is that the media and the news, and obviously it's not new information to hear that things are, more positive tests are coming back, with everything else in the other states. So we're seeing, positivity rates going up. We're seeing, which then I think inversely causes the individuals to start going to get tested more and more frequently. I believe that would be my understanding, but I don't know exactly why people are coming out more, but I think more or less it's everyone understands that this is, reading the news and the media with everything else in other states that Texas, Florida, Arizona, all the issues are having and the positivity rates going up, everybody's watching it very closely. The government's watching it closely. The state is, federal government. So I also know that in my opinion, when individuals are also using these test sites, they go and hang out or go and party or go on a trip or go on a vacation. And they want to get back. They want to get tested and make sure they're okay because they may have taken a risk to go down and, for instance, hang out Lake of the Ozarks or go and do some things or go on a vacation or go to Mexico or whatever. They come back, they want to get tested. I've heard that several times at the Bloomington site.
We've seen this big increase, and yet we're still weeks away from school starting, kids going back to the classroom. The community is going to grow by 20,000 with the college students coming back to campus at Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan. How much more demand will that create for testing, do you think? And can Reditas handle all that starting in mid-August?
Yep, we're taking care of Illinois State on the athletic side. We are, cautiously watching our numbers, increasing staffing to make sure that we can handle upticks in volume like we've seen recently. We'll be fine to be able to handle and support our local partners such as Illinois State University, Bradley, Illinois Wesleyan.
That is Reditas CEO Aaron Rossi with Eric Stock. Reditas plans to start a new online pre-registration for COVID testing soon. Rossi says the portal will ask for more specific information about possible symptoms and your recent whereabouts for better research and contact tracing. He says your test results would then come via text or email. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the next installment of the WGLT series, Living Black in Bloomington Normal. The nonprofit Project Oz started to see a troubling trend when the pandemic first began. The fear of exposure to COVID-19 was causing housing insecurity for at-risk young people in McLean County. A few months later, the problem has worsened. Project Oz Executive Director Lisa Thompson tells Ryan Denham how COVID-19 is disrupting young lives in new ways.
We have young people who are living in multi-generational homes, and you have a parent that might be caring for a grandparent, and then you have a young person who is your frontline worker. They are working at your restaurant, the fast food restaurants. They're working in the grocery stores. They're stocking our shelves. They're doing really valuable work to keep our food supply chain moving smoothly. But then what they're also doing is when they return back to their homes, their families have fear that they've contracted COVID-19 or potentially contracted COVID-19. And therefore, they're being asked to leave out of protection of other family members. That's something new. That's something we haven't seen. Most of our youth homelessness is a result of family conflict, a result of poverty, and a result of family homelessness, where a young person detaches from the house out of survival, where a parent can't check into the shelter, or a young person, you know, kind of goes their own way. But having young people leave their home to protect other people in the home is certainly a newer surge of homelessness that pre-pandemic we hadn't experienced.
You just used that word surge to describe what's going on. How bad is it? What are the numbers?
So we certainly have the emergency shelter. We doubled our capacity very quickly, and we increased our bed capacity in transitional living, which provides supportive services, over 50% of where we were. So we moved from 23 beds to 34 beds. What we're doing, I would say, in our emergency shelter is we are trying to get as many kids rehoused as quickly as possible, because we anticipate as the rent moratoriums lift, we're going to see another surge of homelessness. You know, we know the adult homelessness, but particularly youth. So I think our big focus now is getting young people rehoused where we can, and then working to keep families also intact. So you have a lot of people home, right? And so I don't know if you've experienced this, but sometimes when you spend a lot of time out in work and out in school, and then all of a sudden you're home, and you may have smaller living quarters with a lot of people, there's a lot of opportunity for conflict, and a lot of families that are having to navigate that conflict, and sometimes that has become difficult. And so we're trying to keep families connected and preserved.
Now, have you received any additional funding to help with this increased need? I mean, do you have what you need?
Oh, that's a good question. So we received funding from the Federal Family and Youth Service Bureau. That funding, we have existing grants to work with runaway and homeless youth. So that funding was brought into our existing contracts to help offset the surge of clients. It is incredibly helpful right now, but it is also temporary. So it was kind of a one-time increase that will help us through the fall, and then we'll have to reevaluate the sustainability of our capacity. And then we also received some additional funding from the Illinois Department of Human Services, and John Scott Healthcare was really helpful with funding for protective equipment for our staff. I mean, we never stopped working. Our staff have been working with young people from the very beginning with very limited protective gear. And our community is awesome. When this first came out and we couldn't get anything, we had a lot of people come and bring us cloth face masks and hand sanitizers and things that we couldn't get.
Project Oz also provides employment support to young people. What are you seeing right now from employers and their willingness to hire young people? Has their approach to hiring changed at all from your vantage point over the last 4 or 5 months?
Our young people have in some ways never been more valued as frontline workers, because they're receiving a lot of probably overdue accolades that, you know, they've been all along essential to keeping supplies in our community. And so in some ways, I'm happy for our young people that are being recognized for their hard work. So I would say they feel more respected than before. Certainly, they've kept jobs, and they, there's an impact for everybody for all of this. And there's an increased cost to life for our young people too. But I definitely think that our young people, because of their propensity to be our essential workers, have been able to sustain employment and easily get employment in those sectors. However, the trade-off to that is the exposure to COVID-19. And then, of course, the trade-off to that, if you have a family member that's caring for somebody who has an underlying condition, is housing. So that's a pretty big price to pay.
That's Project Oz Executive Director Lisa Thompson speaking with Ryan Denham. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to 89.1 and WGLT.org. Joel Johnson joined the Black Data Processing Association in Central Illinois to encourage Black representation in the IT world. Johnson is an IT professional, object-oriented developer, and entrepreneur of Silky Soul Entertainment. In this conversation for WGLT's series Living Black in Bloomington Normal, Johnson talks with student reporter Darnisha Mitchell. Johnson says helping Black youth earn scholarships through competitions is his proudest accomplishment, but his experience with being the only Black person in the room reminds him of why he pushes for representation.
It was started in 2003, and basically the mission of the organization is to introduce African Americans to information technology and also to network nationally, to network African Americans in information technology so that we can go from the classroom to the boardroom so that we can represent and provide diversity and inclusion to the industry. And so in Central Illinois, we try to introduce students to information technology concepts. And as I said to you before, I'm proud of the fact that we got kids scholarships because they developed components that were nationally recognized.
How do they respond, you know, to being part of the program?
There's two levels to that. We try to encourage all students in our high school computer competition program and our mobile app competition program to try to become producers of computer stuff instead of just like consumers of the apps. And so then they go compete on the national level. We take the cream of the crop, if you will, from our group, and we send them to national and we train them to compete against other groups. And so when in 2016, the team that we trained came in third place and was only behind Atlanta, Georgia, and Washington, D.C., we were ecstatic. And so they won $1,000 scholarships each. And then in 2018, when we sent a young man to compete nationally at the BDPA, the national conference, he won first place, which was a $2,000 scholarship. He created a mobile app.
And now you've mentioned also to the downside of being in IT, especially being a Black man with experience and things like prejudice and things like that.
It's something that you just have to be aware in any professional industry, in any industry really, that not everybody is going to be on your team. That you have to make sure that you are on top of your game, turn in things on time, and have quality in your work so that you aren't singled out for that, and then, you know, you might feel like you're not part of the group that you're working with. Sometimes you do have to study on your own or find people who will help you raise your game, but that's just any professional job that you have. You may run into people who they might be indifferent to you, you know, okay, you're here, or you don't have to be here. I had that experience when I first started working. I come from New Orleans, and so I came to Bloomington Normal to work, and I used to, complain about the social experience here as compared to an urban city. And so I would do that at work sometimes, and one of my coworkers just told me, then leave. And I'm like, I thought to myself, I just started working on this career like a year ago. I don't have the network to be able to just leave. But it just brought out the fact that maybe she thought I had the privilege to be able to say, okay, I don't like this place, I'll go somewhere else. You know, I didn't. And it's still been a challenge as far as Bloomington Normal. It's gotten bigger. It's gotten more opportunities as far as social and things to do outside of work. But even then, it's still, you know, a tension, a little bit of tension as far as dealing with big city versus small town.
When an incident occurred, just how did you feel in that moment?
Felt awkward. Mostly I worked through it on my own. I did have some people who might sympathize or empathize with what I was going through, and so I communicated that with them. But, you know, it's just something when your expectations are different than the general population expectations, then you just become aware of some things like this. You could try to adapt and adjust your expectations so that you can understand the world or place you live in better. Or you can do like a lot of my fellow coworkers did. They did move away for one reason or another to find other opportunities. I just decided to stay.
Joel Johnson is a Salesforce and Java developer at State Farm and owner of Silky Soul Entertainment. He talked with student reporter Darnisha Mitchell for our series Living Black in Bloomington Normal. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.